I have not changed my deodorant in 25 years. Yeah.
Man of habit right here. Man of habit.
Oh, I guess we're starting. Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. And as usual, welcome to Surprise, the show is starting. Make Me Smart.
It's not like I don't
the podcast where
oh
we are joined. Surprise, the show is starting. Where we're joined, as always, by you and our insistent producers. None of us is as smart. Nobody starts the show as well as all of us.
When they
and
say,
none of
go,
us is as
there's
smart.
There's no blathering. Go. Okay.
I like it.
So
it's
we are going to talk telecommunications policy for a little while today because the other day I talked to Ajit Pai, the chairman of the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. Molly has talked to him a number of times in the past, like in the last, what, like 8 months?
The last year, almost exactly, as all of this was happening.
So we're gonna talk a little bit about this thing called net neutrality, why it has gone away in favor of what Chairman Pai prefers to call open internet, and what that might mean for you, me, and the web.
And it is, of course, great timing because at least as we are recording this, we are awaiting the decision. You will already know when you hear this, but the decision on the AT&T Time Warner case, which is almost, you know, I'm jumping ahead a little bit in the rundown, but almost a poster child test case for what could happen in the age of vertical media consolidation. Post net neutrality. Right, I made it sound like a white paper title, didn't? Wasn't that fun?
You kind of did,
but don't
give it away because we're gonna go over that. All right, I got some questions.
All right, so we'll do all that, and then we'll hear from you all your lingering questions about blockchain. Not all of them.
There are a select few, but some.
But the before that, few. You know.
All right, the fixation fix is upon us. I don't even know why you're laughing. You're just laughing at me.
I'm just laughing because I'm trying to imagine how tired you are right now, and it is not even possible.
That actually goes to the thing I was going to talk about a little bit. But do you want to go first, or do you want me to go first?
No, I want you to go first because I'm in suspense as always.
Here's why I'm so tired. I'm so tired because on Sunday night late, I flew to New York to do an early Monday morning interview with Ajit Pai, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. And then I did Marketplace from New York. And then I got on a plane and I came home and I landed at like midnight tonight, which is Tuesday. I was home in bed at like 1:15 this morning. And then I got up for the morning meeting at 10:15. So I'm a little fatigued. But that goes directly into what I want to talk about. The thing I can't actually stop thinking about it. And I'll just tell you the story and then you'll understand. So I get to my hotel room. I'm staying at the Marriott on 49th and Lex. And I get up there and it's like 10:45, 11 o'clock, whatever it is, New York time. And I flip on the tube as I always do. And lo and behold, the Tonys are on. And I got there just in time for Robert De Niro to come out and do whatever award he was doing. I want to say lead actress in a something, but I can't really remember because I was really tired. But what happened was, so I flip it on and I go about and I'm hanging up my suit and this or my shirt and my pants and whatever. And the audio cuts out. And I'm like, oh, that was weird. And then De Niro comes back and then the audio cuts out again. And I'm like, oh, that was weird. And so, and then they go on with the ceremony and this and that and yay, the band's visit and all this jazz. And then later, as I'm trying to fall asleep, I'm flipping through my phone, and I understand that's not conducive to falling asleep. I get that. And it turns out that De Niro had been bleeped because CBS had the live broadcast on a delay, and he had come out and said, bleep Donald Trump. I just want to say that one more time. Bleeping bleep Donald Trump. And here's why that stuck with me. It occurs to me that that is the distillation of this country talking past each other. Or talking past itself. Because the idea that a man of that stature in this culture would come out and say that about a man of Donald Trump's stature in our political culture is kind of problematical. And that he felt liberated enough to do that, no matter what you think of the president and his policies. And I understand there are millions of people on both sides who disagree with each other. The idea that it's okay somehow to say that on a national broadcast celebrating the arts, I don't get that. And it goes to the breakdown at the G7 and you know, Peter Navarro saying there's a special place in hell for Justin Trudeau, for which he has later apologized. That bums me out. That's it. That's my trip to New York and back.
And dark mode.
Well, no. I am not owning the dark mode on that one.
I will say.
All right.
No, and I'm not in dark mode.
Okay.
I I have had similar conversations over the actually kind of over the weekend that were sparked up all over again by there was a Paul Krugman thread on Twitter.
Yep.
You know, that said, look, the media is now amounting to being pro-Trump because they won't acknowledge that some of these policies are founded upon presumptions that are simply not true.
Right.
You know, like, I'm making this policy because of this thing that I assert that is true that is not true.
You bet.
And so it led to the conversation about how to treat that. And I said, well, look, I think media is in – I think everybody is in the same bind, which is talking past each other, that even if – The New York Times said, we're going to print that these statements were riddled with lies, right? If they were going to drop the L-bomb, that not only drop the L-bomb, that it wouldn't help, that it would cheapen the discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I find myself in this weird position where, sure, I guess I want the media to be honest and not be complicit in the Trump presidency, which it is, that's not a good idea. Like, no one should talk the way that people are now talking.
Right.
Nobody in the media, you know, Elon Musk should not be journalists of fake news and of agenda. And nobody should be responding to the press with the statements that they are, nor will the press help any. I mean, I've been on this weird, like, what would Jesus do campaign. It's like, how do we respond to everything with radical love at this point? Because the level of anger that everybody's responding with on whatever side is so alienating that you'd never make any progress.
And what's the climb down? And I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know.
All right.
But we're
turn.
On a bear hunt now, that's for sure. well, interestingly, my fixation is also related to breakdown, I guess. And it's to breakdown of government. I saw these twin stories that talk, and this is actually going to lead us, I think, into our net neutrality conversation and the conversation we've been having about how business is ascendant. And so one of these stories was like a funny dystopia story about Domino's Pizza planning to unveil, like literally unveiling, not the Onion apparently, a U.S. infrastructure project to fill potholes.
Yep.
Domino's Pizza.
Yep. Yep.
Will smooth the ride home. That is what we have come to when government abdicates and business is ascendant. And you know, it used to be a public-private partnership, and now it's just like somebody tweeted, you know, we're going to kickstart our healthcare. I had a whole conversation with a friend this weekend about mental health because of Anthony Bourdain and the ways in which we are all kind of trying to find these gap solutions for systems that don't work.
Yep.
And increasingly, you know, startups are saying, well, that's my job. Or Domino's Pizza is saying, it's our job to deal with potholes. And then Amazon is saying to Seattle City Council, and this was my other obsession this weekend, no way in hell are we going to pay that head tax to help deal with the housing crisis and homelessness in Seattle. Mm-hmm. Seattle, you know, passed a tax on large businesses. A per head tax to raise money to help with the housing crisis and homelessness that's been exacerbated by their great tech economy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Amazon, which has all the power in that world in the city, said, no way. No way. And they are going to repeal it. The Seattle City Council is going to vote to repeal
that tax. Are they? Is that a deal, do you think? Because Amazon.
I mean, it looks like it.
That's
in fact, several city council people were quoted in the Hill saying, yeah, we're gonna vote for it. Because business groups came out in force led by Amazon. And then here's Amazon, you know, getting all these cities to sort of bend over backwards with all of these concessions.
Jeff Bezos is playing those cities for suckers. Are you kidding me? Please.
He unquestionably is.
Yeah.
But there are no checks and balances on business right now. And some of them are acting in good ways and others are acting in bad ways. But there's no question that the end goal of a business is not to help everybody. And yet, when they're the ones filling potholes, like, it feels like our dystopian future has arrived in some ways.
I see what you did there with the whole checks and balances on business, because we're going to do a little bit of that in about, what, 45 seconds?
Why, yes,
oh,
we are.
Goodness. All right.
Look at how he just picked up the snap.
I'm no dope. So tweet us at Kyle Risdahl and Molly Wood. You can email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. We'll be back in a minute.
My Monday was the day that net neutrality was officially repealed. It had taken a while after the vote, and FCC Chairman Ajit Pai was doing a bit of a victory lap. Making he wrote an op-ed in CNET. Yeah, he was making the rounds, talking to Kai. And obviously, it has been super controversial. People have been so, I mean, to that point about the discourse. Nothing about the net neutrality arguments on either side has been even remotely rational.
Not at all.
And now here we are, and it happened, and now what?
Yeah, well, so let me just actually, just on that civil point, and we're not going to play this clip, but Ajit Pai, the chairman of the FCC, a government official doing his job as he sees fit, right, has gotten death threats, which is
so many.
Insanity.
Yep.
That's nutty.
So
That's
many.
Nutty.
And his family?
Yep.
Has been threatened. I mean, it is unacceptable the level of rhetoric that this has gotten to. And you probably, I've just only seen a couple tweets go by, but even interviewing him is like a landmine, right?
People are just horrified that I would even talk to him. And I'm like, what is the, how can you not talk to this guy?
Yeah.
I don't get it.
And on the one hand, it speaks to the importance of the internet in people's lives.
Yep. Yep.
On the other hand, it speaks to the fact that everybody has gone completely insane. I mean, that policy is an attack on one side or the other. And So just to be clear, dear listeners, that's not okay.
Yeah.
You don't threaten the life of government officials. You just don't. Anyway, but we are going to take this opportunity, which we don't always get to do, to dissect things in a rational manner a little bit, which is what we try to do at Make Me Smart anyway, break down a couple of the points, right?
Yeah. So the deal with Chairman Pai's Open Internet, Restore Internet Freedom Order is the technical name of it, is that as opposed to mandating that there is net neutrality, that is to say that all internet service providers have to treat all traffic equally, the current chairman of the FCC, a Republican and a GOP appointee to the chairmanship, is going to let market forces rule and ensure that competition is the method by which broadband availability in this country is increased. That is his ultimate goal here. And here's what he said when I asked him about that.
The complaint that consumers have about the internet is that there's not enough access and competition. Those big companies that you mentioned are not going to invest in places like Royston, Georgia, or small town Vermont, or the Rosebud Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. I've visited these places, and I know that the business case is hard. We need to incentivize the smaller companies to provide a competitive alternative. You can't do that with these heavy-handed regulations.
Now, my response to that in the moment was, yeah, but look, AT&T is not competing in Dahlonega, Georgia, right? They're not the ones dealing with that. And I don't understand how keeping market forces as the driver are going to help them. And that's where I came down on that one.
Yeah, I at one point did sort of a Twitter explainer on net neutrality and said, look, whether you believe that this is going to work comes down to how much you trust business and the free market. And so you have to trust that the free market is somehow going to drive these broadband providers into these areas, into these rural areas, which so far it has not. And you also have to believe that once they get there and they are probably the only game in town, which is the case for 50 million Americans at least, that they're not going to misbehave. That they're not going to charge exorbitant rates or push other providers out or discriminate against traffic. And you have kind of, to the earlier point in the show, this utter faith in business and the market without any – and then it sort of – you know, that gets at the central question, which was that the rules that were put in place in 2015 classified these services as a utility. They said that's how important they are and that's the way – now, to be fair, they didn't say – and here's a bunch of money to build out the federal highway system to Royston, Georgia. But obviously the new administration's not doing that either.
Yeah. So we actually ought to get into the Title I, Title II thing. And I'm going to keep this super high level. But one of the things that happened in 2015 was that the Federal Communications Commission moved internet service providers from what is called Title I coverage, that is to say as information service providers, to Title II common carriers, which lets them regulate the internet and internet service providers as a utility. That is to say, like the electric company. And I've said before on this program that the internet now is so important to this economy that there's a case to be made that they ought to be regulated that way. Pai said, no, we're going to put them back here in Title I and have what he likes to call a lighter touch. So that's where that comes from. And I think I take him at his word. He actually believes this is going to work. And mm-hmm. and file this one under elections have consequences, right? Because his appointment as chairman is a direct result of the 2016 election and, oh, parenthetically, is in line with the regulatory rollback that President Trump has instituted in other sections of this economy. Close parenthesis.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because I feel like his actions, I mean, again, it speaks to how consequential the internet is in people's mm-hmm. lives. But his actions sort of couldn't be more in line
totally.
With a Republican
totally.
Administration. And frankly, his tone, except for a few cases where, and I think we have a clip of this, where he tends to accuse the proponents of net neutrality of buying into fake news and being hysterical weirdos. But generally speaking, his tone has been pretty professional about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's been remarkably consistent, I think we can agree.
Yeah.
talking points in his characterization of the light touch versus the heavy-handed regulations.
So let's play this one. And this is from Molly 6 months ago, 8 months ago, right?
Yes, it is.
Well, look, I know that people are very passionate about all things having to do with the internet, and I would hope that they would focus on the facts and, to the maximum extent possible, ignore some of the hysteria about the internet ending. When they wake up on December 15th and they realize that the internet actually does work and they're able to tweet and email and surf and do all the great things that people are able to do on the internet, they'll recognize that they should put the hysteria aside and focus on the facts. And the facts are that this regulatory framework we are about to adopt is the one that is proven to work for the American people and will continue to benefit them in the exciting times to come.
Exciting times to come.
That is actually a pretty calm, like sort of a nice way to put that. But I also want to play just the briefest snippet of his first answer to the first question that I asked him, which was, who are the losers going to be if net neutrality goes away?
Those who have peddled hysteria and misinformation over the last 3 weeks, suggesting, for example, that the internet as we know it is about to end, that democracy is threatened, that free speech and expression are online are at risk. And when folks wake up on December 15th and the internet is the same and we have returned to the free market framework that has governed the internet for most of its existence, hopefully we can return to a more rational discourse about the future of this terrific online platform that has delivered so much digital opportunity to Americans and to people around the world.
And he essentially has said, and it sounds like he said it to you a little bit too, that the people who oppose rolling back these rules only oppose it because they've been lied to. And that is the part where, especially given the changing landscape, like we cannot set aside, you know, there's the internet in 2015, there's the internet in 2010. Even since 2015, you've seen this crazy wave of vertical integration where increasingly the providers of internet service are either investing in buying or even creating original content that they mm-hmm. want to distribute that puts them directly into conflict with existing providers like Netflix or Hulu or Amazon or Apple or Google or Facebook, and that there is every reason to fear that that inherent conflict of interest will at some point become their business model.
Mm-hmm. You bet. You bet.
And that part isn't hysteria. That is actual. That's, you know, their business case for staying alive is we have to zero rate services. We have to say you can have all the, you know, T-Mobile can say, well, you can have all the free Netflix you want if you switch to T-Mobile, or AT&T, which owns DirecTV, and this is the one where it's even more obvious, can say you can have all the DirecTV you want and won't ever count against your data cap.
Yeah. Now, let me practice what I'm preaching here in the taking people with good intentions, right?
Yes.
The last thing I asked him yesterday is, look, we had a long conversation about his view of how to regulate the internet, and then my last question was, what if you're wrong? So let's play his answer to that one.
Mm.
then it's up to regulators and elected office holders to make the appropriate decision. But I would turn it around and I'd say, what evidence would be necessary for the fearmongers who've proclaimed this the end of the internet as we know it? What evidence would be necessary for them to agree that our regulatory approach is the right one? I've got 20 years of history on my side. For those who have said that this is the end of the internet starting today, what evidence would be necessary for them to be able to concede, you know, maybe Ajit did have a point that we actually do want the internet networks to ramp up to accommodate this traffic. Is there anything that would persuade them? And if not, then we're obviously having more of a political debate as opposed to a policy one.
So look, setting aside the whole fearmongers thing, which goes back to his pattern of using loaded words that detract from his art, it's so interesting. And he needs a little media training, honestly, because otherwise he's very consistent. He's got a point, right? What's it going to take for people to actually stand back and say, you know what? The Republicans won. He's the chairman. Passed on a 3-2 vote. This is the way this country goes. Let's roll with it.
Yeah.
What's it going to take? And I don't know the answer to that one, because as you said, even just interviewing this guy gets you all kinds of hate comments and hate emails and hate tweets. It's the funniest thing.
Yeah. And it is a political philosophy that has been consistent to this party for decades.
Yep.
I mean, and America, frankly, has always had a different regulatory regime. Like, you can look at the EU and say, there isn't the same internet economy.
Oh yeah.
Because we had a Wild West approach to investment. And now that doesn't set aside the fact that not all of his arguments are 100% honest. Like the data that shows that broadband investment has declined significantly since the the Title II reclassification in 2015, that data is conflicting at best.
We should be clear. He says it's declined. The actual provider of that data says you can't draw any conclusions.
Well, and, Comcast said to its own investors in its SEC filings, our investment was up, $3 billion. Like, this is how much money we put. But to his point, part of the reason that because investment was shoddy and terrible in broadband and wireless for years and years and years because there wasn't any competition. So the reason that these companies are finally investing is because they are feeling the pressure from consumers who want better service because there is competition. Like wireless broadband now is even in places where you only have one or two providers, you might be able to substitute some wireless service for your crappy home broadband. That's putting pressure on them to build out their networks. The pure capitalist argument that more competition will spur more investment is true, and that has been the problem with broadband and internet investment specifically in this country. And so if these policies include actual incentives, right, or even subsidies to increase broadband investment across this country, then I think you could be persuaded that a lack of regulation but an increase in competition – led to more investment. It's the competition part, though, that is highly unproven so far. But I think that was a totally – that's so interesting that that's what you thought, too, because I also came away from talking with Ajit Pai thinking that despite the accusations of double dealing and the kind of like absurd speed with which he moved and he stripped away every consumer protection, right? He went even further than just getting rid of the 2015 rules. But I believe that his motivations are philosophically sincere.
He believes what he's doing. He absolutely believes what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know? And you got to let that play out. Let us know what you think about this. Because look, if the past like 15 minutes of our lives are any indication, this is a convoluted topic. make me smart at marketplace.org. Hit us up. Your comments, your thoughts, your questions, those places where you think Ajit Pai is full of baloney or where you think he's right. And same for me and Molly, but be gentle on that part, please.
Well, also, approach us with love and maybe we'll agree with you.
Oh,
just saying. Approach us with love.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
All right, it's that mailbox thing.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
Hi, Al Groves from Lawrenceville, Georgia.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Answer the question you want to answer, not the question
never
you
gets
want
old.
To a lot of follow-ups on the whole blockchain conversation that we had last week.
Yeah, let's stop talking about that really complicated net neutrality broadband investment Title II. And then just make it way easier.
Oh, my God. So Ari Cohen had a question. What business problem does blockchain technology try to solve? And I don't know the answer to that one. I think maybe they're doing it just because they could do it.
I mean, all of them. Haven't you talked to the blockchain people?
Well,
all
yeah.
of them.
Yeah.
Okay, but fundamentally, the business issue that blockchain is trying to solve is the issue of trust, is the issue of verification. And in theory, it can cut out a whole swath of middlemen, because you will have a computerized ledger to have tracked all your things, right? Your transactions or your interactions or your contracts. And that verifiable record can provide trust where previously there might have only been bribes and clipboards. Just as one, you know, just one example. So yes, I think proponents would tell you it is trying to solve the problem of both trust and middlemen.
Novie do provie, yo. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, that. Couple of you. Oh, this is like my favorite topic, too. A couple of you.
Oh, really? Oh, interesting.
Yes, like this is. We should do a whole episode on this because it is fascinating. Several of you asked about blockchain's energy use, and we got this voicemail on that topic.
Hello, Kai and Molly. This is Karen from Minneapolis. By some estimates, mining Bitcoins will consume more energy than the entire United States uses by 2019 and the world uses by 2020. There are lots of proposals for how to reduce the energy wasted by Bitcoin mining and blockchain in general, but that is why this podcast is called Make Me Smart, because you'll need to find someone a lot smarter than me to understand and explain why Bitcoin tech uses so much energy and whether it can be fixed and be usable in the future.
Well, the why is pretty easy, right? Because you have all these computer servers, some of them specially designed and high-powered, to literally grind away making the calculations that spit out bitcoins or fractions thereof at the end. I don't know, though, what can be done to reduce that, because computers is computers.
And they have to be super powerful computers. Yeah. I mean, they're not. And it's so, yeah, if you have ever, this may not be the most relatable anecdote, but if you've ever designed a super custom gaming rig or know anyone who has.
Oh, my God. Geek alert.
I know, totally. Haven't you guys ever built your own gaming rig? Like, oh my God.
Losers.
Once you start overclocking and air cooling, and it's not because, okay, now I'm down the rabbit hole.
Wow.
It's not just the actual processor, right? Like, you've got your actual processor and it's super powerful or whatever, and then you overclock it to make it even more powerful. And then actually what probably uses the most energy is the cooling, because you have to cool the crap out of those computers so they don't explode from all the heat from all the processing that they're doing. So there are like air-cooled rigs and water-cooled rigs and like water displacement, and it goes on and on.
We're going to isolate that and put it in some promo, man. Are you kidding me? Oh, my God.
And
every week we've got a promo-capable cut here from one of us.
There was this amazing study. Like, I don't know. This is a growing story, but not fully told. There was at least one study that said that Bitcoin mining used more electricity in a year than all of Ireland.
Oh yeah, I totally believe that. I mean, Ireland's tiny. Bitcoin is giant. Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's stories about, you know, they're setting up Bitcoin mining farms in Puerto Rico, right? Where like the whole infrastructure is falling apart, but they're, I mean, it's a big deal.
Yeah. And I don't know what the answer is. All right.
Solar?
Moving on. Yes, solar. How are we doing with that? Jeffrey Gelrach, or Gelrach, I apologize, thinks blockchain is more than just a trend. It's here to stay, which is probably true, although an editorial comment here, unproven. He writes, much of the talk about blockchain is skepticism about the upside. I hearken back to a lawyer telling me the internet is just a fad back in 1994. Facebook, now that's a fad. Blockchain is certainly not. End of quote. Yeah, it could be, but there's a long, I personally think there's a long way to go until it's trusted as a store of value and trust. I mean, I just do.
Do you mean it in the currency way or
currency
in the technology
or
way?
Or anything? I mean, I think it's still too black boxy for the general public to trust it.
It's one of those things, though, man. If you can be one of the ones who figures it out sooner than everybody else, as with all things, and you use your competitive advantage. Because I actually think the underlying tech, the blockchain technology, does have all of the potential they have ascribed to it. It just, you know, has to be programmed separate from mining coins, actual blockchain and putting stuff and creating that network of trust and having the ledger. I mean, it's not that radical of a concept even. So it shouldn't be that hard to implement. It's just how companies actually go around doing it. All right. Ian Deckert left us a voicemail about how laws and blockchain are, speaking of which, it's not a radical concept. Laws and blockchain, he said, are not all that different.
We already have a paper blockchain called the law. One of the things reported on during last year's tax bill was how complicated the wording of that bill was, or not was, but is. That is an important distinction because even the bits of prior law that it overwrites are still there for anyone to see. They are not totally erased. You could even say that it adds an argument to the beginning of the code that says skip these specific lines. I will just end with the thought that this sort of code will never be 100% correct, but that might be good enough.
Far be it for me to criticize, shall we say, a listener to this particular program. But look, have you ever read a law? Have you ever read? Did you read the tax bill? Maybe Ian Deckard is a tax lawyer and he does read these things. But holy cow, for laymen to go in and try to read a law is well nigh incomprehensible. And I guess that's my counter analogy is exactly lay people trying to go in and understand what this thing means. That ain't gonna fly.
Oh no! But it's not meant for it. That was very.
I don't know.
That was so modern. Okay. we're off the rails. Reel it in, Rizdahl. Oh, I actually think that the law is a hilariously good analogy for exactly the reason that you said, which is blockchain is incomprehensible. The ledgers, I mean, we try to look at those people's marriage contract that they put on the blockchain.
Yeah.
And it was utterly incomprehensible. Right. And yet it serves a relatively valuable purpose in that it holds society together.
Yeah, totally.
So, you know, I think it's fair.
Change your pace? Change your pace, right?
Yes, let's.
Okay.
Let's.
All right. An answer, a celebrity answer, if you will, to the Make Me Smart question.
Something I thought I knew.
That's a really tough question.
That's a big old hunker of a question.
Gosh, that is good.
The Make Me Smart question. Last week, I got the chance to talk to Melinda Gates because can we just say that the producers here at Marketplace are awesome?
Yeah, super cool,
like,
interview,
pew,
by
pew.
Super cool.
Would you like to talk to Ajit Pai or Melinda Gates? Like, we got that for you.
don't good, give them, don't, they'll, the heads, their heads won't be able to fit in the studio door. Come on.
I'm fine with that. They all deserve extra cookies. Melinda Gates, she was fascinating. She's a cool person to talk to. We talked about her career in tech, how to collect better data on women in the workforce. She made that amazing statement that possibly video games is what basically booted women out of the tech industry. It was super interesting. And obviously, I made sure, even without a cheat sheet, to ask her favorite question.
I once thought I knew that women were far enough along in society in the United States than they really are. And I've learned that that's just not true. When you look at how few women there are in Congress, and you look at the change when you have a woman leading the questions on a Senate panel of the military, you see the different types of questions, the values questions, the expectations change. When you see how few women are on boards today, and one woman on a board can't make a difference, you have to have two or three, and then the business changes. When you think of how few women CEOs there are at the top of corporations in the United States, and yet there are so many women working in society today, that's just not right. And so we have to ask ourselves, how did we get here and what can we do to change society? And then we all need to be a part of using our voice or using our resources or using our talent to change those things in the United States.
Amen. I mean, you know, what else do you say about that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think that as a coda to all of our earlier thoughts about discourse and the changing nature of conversation, there are a lot of things that that some Americans felt pretty complacent about for a while. And a lot of those assumptions, I think, have been shaken up. It's sort of the equal and opposite reaction theory to the Trump administration. A lot of those assumptions have been shaken up by elections having consequences and the realization that perhaps what some people considered social progress was not as far along as they thought it was. Yeah. And I think that good work will be done as a result.
Yes.
And that's my not dark mode.
Yeah. And I think that's where we end. Review us on Apple Podcasts, if you will. Subscribe, tell your friends. It's all good. And tell us what you think. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Molly's at Molly Wood. Make me smart on marketplace.org. Yeah, you know, hit us up.
Yeah, and record your answer to the
Make Me Smart
question.
Yeah,
what is something you thought you knew and you found out you were wrong about?
Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. Senior producer is Eve Tro. Our digital stuff is done by Tony Wagner. This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostad. Our theme music was composed by, I do that every week. I think it's a was composed. By
it really Ben stresses
well,
you out.
It's a tense thing. I don't know. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez are the guys who get the credit for that.
The executive director of On Demand is Latara Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. Next week, let's just switch it up and you can have the easy one.
That's all right. That's all
present
right.
Tense for both Latara and Deb.
Or maybe not, depending on how things go. One never wants to.
I'm just come saying. On.
What?
For I don't people, know. You just you,
could all be
you took it to the you took
firing.
It to the spill in the tea.
Well, you know. All right. Bye.
Bye.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.